Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me out, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And welcome to the Shame Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. This evening, we are going to be talking to Katrina Radke. Katrina is a therapist, a marriage family therapist. She also has a brand new book out called Be Your Best Without the Stress. Kind of catchy title. And she's got an interesting background as a former Olympic swimmer. Apparently started on the farm, became an Olympic swimmer, then went from bedridden and beyond. This is going to be an interesting story. I can't wait to let her tell us all about it. Katrina, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled to. I mean, yours is very definitely not a rags-to-riches story, but certainly a story that I think is going to inspire a lot of people. I love stories that overcome immense obstacles where a lot of people would probably think, oh, it's all over. So can we start from the beginning and give us a little picture about the farm town girl?
Well, I grew up in a small town of Morris, Minnesota, about 5,000 people, and I like Lolly's little kids. You know, I did a bunch of different activities and sports, and loved playing with my neighbors and friends. And I had two older brothers who were also active in different things. And one of the things that we did was we swam. And when they were going to the pool, I basically begged my parents to let me go with them to the pool. And to be able to be in a place where I could swim as well. And there was about 15 or 25 kids or so on the team, and I was in a place initially where I was afraid to even go down to the deep end because I was afraid of animals or something that might be down in the deep end where you can't see. But as time went on, obviously, I loved just being in the water and being able to grow up in a small town where there was no pressure to be the best or that kind of thing, but just really love what you're doing was a major focus. And I was blessed to be able to get started at a young age, at about age 7 or so, but not have to be so serious about it until about age 10 or 11.
Okay. So at 10 or 11, you started getting really serious about swimming?
Yes, about that time. I grew up and I loved being in the water. I remember being around 4th grade when I was about 9 or 10, and I was just really enjoying swimming. And then my dad was transferred to Australia to on a sabbatical for a year, and we ended up living over there. And during that time, I really got to why, just by chance where we were living, we were in a place where they had a top coach and a couple other athletes who were trying to make their Olympic team in Australia. And so I got to watch them train, and I was very, very excited about that whole process.
Wow. And what was your parents' relationship to that? Were they encouraging, discouraging, or kind of neutral?
But they were just happy that I found something that I really liked to do, and they had allowed us to see everything, you know, along the way to know that, hey, okay, is this something you really want to pursue? But I think, like any family, you want your kid to be happy, you want them to be pursuing something they really like to do. And
yeah.
From there, they were very excited about it, actually. But I remember when I was about, we came back from Australia, it was a big turning point for me and my family because I knew I really wanted to swim, but to get to the level I really wanted to get to, which is Olympic Games, I hope I'd be able to do it from my small town because there really wasn't a big coach there, and not that you need it, but I was in a position where I needed some more support to take me to the next level. And so we had long conversations. I ended up staying with a family in Minneapolis area, which is about 3 hours from my hometown, so that I could actually pursue my dream of making the Olympics.
Wow. Wow, that is just so amazing. So did you have any physical or health obstacles getting to the Olympics, or was that kind of a slam dunk for you?
Well, it's interesting. I was totally healthy, normal, like anybody, until about age 15. At that point, I had already been on the U.S. national team for a year, and I had I ended up having mononucleosis. And I was in a position where I was like, oh, you know, I had just missed making the world championship team that year, and I thought, what's wrong? And meanwhile, I was very sick in bed with 103 fever and mono, and ended up being sick for about 2 months, really, you know, really, really sick, where I couldn't swim. And I didn't know if I'd ever, you know, get over it. But that's really the first challenge that I had on the health side towards ultimately, you know, taking care of my health.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So that didn't pose a huge obstacle to the Olympics for you, though, did it?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was in denial. I was in a place where I was like, I knew I wasn't well, and yet at the same time, I thought I got better by, you know, resting for a few months, and I was more interested in getting back in the water versus accepting the fact that maybe there was something still really wrong. But so I justified that I was still fine, even though I wasn't totally healthy. And I thought I was able to rationalize pretty well because I was like, okay, well, if I do X, Y, and Z, then I must be fine. So I still trained really well, but I was just getting, you know, I was chronically more and more tired, and I didn't know why. And so at the time, it still was, my body wasn't not, it was still functioning and able to compete, and I was able to get through, have very intense training. But as time went on, you know, up to the Olympic Games, I was, you know, still not totally healthy, but I was able to still compete at a very high level. It wasn't until later I ended up really getting down with the debilitating chronic illness of chronic fatigue syndrome.
Oh, wow. Okay. So then later you get chronic fatigue, and what else?
Well, it's called chronic fatigue syndrome, and it's or the bigger name is CFIDS, for chronic fatigue immune dysfunction syndrome. And basically what it means is your immune system is totally, you know, it's suppressed and not working. And a lot, at the time when I was dealing with it, a lot of doctors did not even know how to treat it. And it, so they would just say, oh, take this pill and see if that gets you well. Oh, just to get some rest. Maybe you just need to stop swimming. And meanwhile, there was no solution. There was no... It's not like you could say, oh, I have a broken leg, or it's this specific kind of cancer. It was something that was very unknown at the time of how to treat. And even to this day, they don't really know exactly what causes it, but they do know that it's a real illness that many, many people have, and so they're starting to actually look at different ways to treat it. So one big thing is that the symptoms of it is you're such that you feel like you have the flu all the time, or you have arthritis and... low-grade fevers, and I had numbness. I couldn't think. My brain, you know, there were a lot of symptoms that hit me all at once that made me feel like I couldn't think the same way. I wasn't able to, like, walk around. I'd just be knocked out for days. And it's kind of funny looking back at it now, all that the issue that I did deal with, because now I'm totally healthy and well and vibrant and back to my normal self. So... a very different experience.
Well, what age were you when the chronic fatigue set in?
What age was I?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, I was 15 when I had mono, and I was kept competing. And at age 21 when I was finally able to accept the fact that something was seriously wrong. Like, my organs were just not functioning as well, and my forehead felt swollen, and I was in this place where I didn't know what was going on. So it was about age 21 when I actually finally really accepted it. And I went to that period. I was probably, you know, really, really sick for about 3 years. It took me about 8 to 10 years to even finally recover from it. And then actually was able to come back and compete again at age 33, which was such a wonderful experience, and go back to Olympic trials and be world-ranked again. So I went through a huge journey. You know, I made lemonade out of lemons pretty good, but I had a big, you know, I had a lot of obstacles to face along the way. And I share some of this in my book, and I also became a therapist, and I share tools for other people, because we all deal with adversity and obstacles, whether it's chronic illness or injury or stressors or distractions that show up for us. And the key is, how do we actually deal with them? And for me, even too, like, how do you deal with success? You know, here I was at a very young age, age 17, Olympic athlete, and it's wonderful, a great experience. But even Olympic athletes are human beings. We all still also face adversity.
You're a very driven person. How do you maintain that kind of a drive? I think for some people, they're just like, they can't relate.
Well, it's funny you say that, because, you know, there was points where I just wanted to give up. And ironically for me, it was easier to go numb and pretend that I wasn't sick. So I fought it for like a couple of years, and I learned, you know, I just pulled it. And then finally I got to the place where I just had to surrender and give up. and actually not have the drive. And I was, yes, I was so driven, but I was almost afraid to stop being driven. And I was afraid of just being a nobody. And I have a chapter in my book called that, you know, afraid to stop and be a nobody. And to realize that underneath our roles and achievements that we actually do in our lives, there's something much greater that we're actually looking for. And, you know, we're all seeking something. And sometimes we think it's a house or car or a certain title or that medal. But like my subtitle says, it's not about the medal. There's a much something much greater. And in the process of me actually training, I realized that. I realized that the thing that I loved the most was not so much, you know, going to international competition and winning a medal, as much as being able to every day, day in, day out, see what is possible for me on this given day. What is my best possible thing I can do for myself? How good can I be on this given moment? How can I test myself on this set? And what happens is I realize that in those moments I get immersed in what I'm doing, like any of us can do, and we're pursuing what we love, and we stay committed to the path of it, regardless of what does show up along the way. We realize that in those moments when we get immersed in what we're doing and time seems to stand still, that is the beauty of what we're looking for all of us.
Hmm. Wow, it's very inspiring. So after the Olympics, you go on to become a therapist. Well, that doesn't usually follow. So what led to that decision?
Well, I think having been so sick for so long, even though I was in denial, and I'd always been interested in how human people, you know, how human beings behave, and I'd always been interested in what motivates us to do what we do. And so even before I, you know, competed internationally, I was always very fascinated by that. And so it seemed that was very natural. But on the other hand, I was, you know, before I got really sick, I was on this path to be an international business person and travel the world a lot and just, you know, be active that way and be very adventurous. And I think I was able to slow down enough and realize that, you know, one of my greatest gifts that I have to offer is to be able to share my story, to be vulnerable, to let people know it's okay to do that. And by doing so, I'm actually more in my power. And so I went to grad school to become a therapist, more to be able to empower other people to be true to who they are, and through that, be able to impact people in a whole different way.
Wow. So do you find that your clients are really drawn in by the whole Olympic thing, or do some of them not even know about that?
Yes, that's correct. I remember, it's funny, I was in graduate school in Connecticut, in New Haven, and I remember one of my patients found out, it was around 1996, and I was just finishing up my internship, and it was an article that was written about me having swam in the Olympics and this kind of thing. It was the Olympics, you know, right from Lance Olympic Games. She goes, wow, I didn't even know that you were an Olympian.
Huh?
And it was really funny because, yeah, most people didn't really even know. And,
yeah.
Of course, and it's funny because once you get, you know, I have no idea what it's like to be like a Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie or somebody who's so famous you have paparazzi following you all the time. It was nothing like that. But to all of a sudden be labeled something that everybody usually looks up to and puts a certain label on you because of your title, because of something you did, sometimes you want to pretend it doesn't exist. And sometimes you don't, and there was a period where I did not want to embrace the fact that I was an Olympian and somebody who other people really looked up to. And I wanted to just be considered a normal human being because that's really what I am. And it's kind of like, you know, when Michael Phelps did this summer, you know, here he is, you know, greatest Olympian of all time, winning 22 medals, which is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
He's still a normal human being just doing what he loves to do. And he just happens to have, you know, a lot of God-given talent, and he had a big drive and was focused on what he really wanted to create for himself. And, of course, that's unique. But at the same time, it's like we all have the ability to share our gifts, and his gift is swimming. And my gift was swimming in many, many ways, and now my gift is really working with other people to find their gifts. And initially, it can be overwhelming when all of a sudden we're thrown into a pedestal position, but then you really I really love helping other people say, look, you know, when I met my first Olympian, I thought they were something much greater than myself, and then I realized that I had that gift and power within myself, too, and that we all put our pants on the same way in the morning, and we can realize that just because somebody achieved something really extraordinary doesn't mean that they are better than us, that we can also have that dream and say, hey, what if I do that, too? And it creates a very different reality for what is possible in this world for all of us.
Who are some of your inspirations? Do you look up to certain people as having been pivotal for you in your own development?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember when I was younger, of course, a swimmer that I was very inspired by was a woman named Tracy Calkins, and she was somebody who had two older brothers and very similar in terms of my background, and she was somebody who had won over 40 national titles in the swimming world. But then, of course, I've even been inspired by, you know, just even studying people online. Like, it could be Einstein, it could be His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or it can be anybody that, you know, you can tell that they're really pursuing what they love to do. And you watch a concert of some musician, and you go, wow, it's so amazing what they're doing. They're just purely on stage in the moment doing what they're here to do. And those are all inspirations for me.
Well, okay. So let's go back to when you get mono and you're trying out for the Olympics, because it seems like that's the first time you experienced a little bit of trouble. And I'm wondering how you get past that first one. I think that would be helpful for our listeners to understand. Maybe there's a moment where you had kind of an epiphany, which then helped you with the chronic fatigue later on. Was there?
Yes, it was kind of like the initial. It's kind of funny you say that, because I've also experienced, you know, somebody who also deals with you know, death or something like that. I mean, maybe they experience a slight loss, and then obviously a really serious loss later. And sometimes it is kind of like a transition point. It's interesting you said that, because I've never really thought about it that way. But that's really what it was. When I first had mono, it was kind of like, oh, wow, like, what if I didn't have swimming in my life? It would be very, very different. I love this sport, and all of a sudden it'd be gone and taken away. And I couldn't,
right.
You know, mono, I just knew, okay, I'm going to get back into this. I'm going to get well again. And I really believed that I was going to be okay. However, initially, I still had this dream of being an Olympian and swimming and competing internationally. And I was afraid, like, what if I actually put all my energy into something and it doesn't happen? And we all can relate to this one. And I was in that teenage years where, you know, we don't want to admit that, you know, I'm into boys at that time. I want to go out and have my own, go out and party, we all enjoy my own life. And, you know, that's a point where oftentimes as teenagers, we don't really want to even listen to what our parents have to say. And out of this place that I really had to go back in deep within and say, okay, is it really still worth pursuing the Olympic dream? Maybe it won't happen. Maybe I won't get healthy. What if I don't? And I really had those doubts. And it's funny, as we try to, when we have to come up, sometimes we want to prove ourselves right, like, well, maybe I'm not worthy of this dream, or maybe I can't do it, so it's not even worth pursuing, so I'm going to go ahead and just sabotage it before I even get there, because that way it's just safer. I don't have to deal with the pain of actually going through all this work and then not having my dream become a reality.
Right.
Because there's no guarantee. But I realized during that time, I remember, you know, going, okay, well, there's no guarantee, and yes, it's fun to go hang out with friends that are not athletes and that kind of stuff, but am I really satisfied doing this? Would I be satisfied if I gave up my swimming career in order just to hang out and socialize when I know that I'm so close? Wouldn't I feel better about myself if I actually still pursued what I want, even if I didn't make it? After all, there's no guarantees. And so that's the path I end up taking, is saying, yes, I'd rather go after what I really, really want and commit to it full-heartedly, even if I don't do it. Or even if I exceed beyond my wildest expectations, because that has its own set of, you know, stress that can come on. And during that process, I was able to get back into the zone of just being able to do what I wanted to do. And it's kind of interesting, because when I got to Olympic trials in 1988, I actually ended up, you know, my first event was a 200 freestyle, which was my main event leading up to the Olympic, you know, Olympic trials. And I was assumed that I was going to make it in that event. Well, ironically, I did not even make finals. I was 10th after the preliminaries, and only top 8 made finals. And so, you know, on one level, I could have been devastated, and then me could have been over. But instead, I was like, no, I have another chance at another event. Even though the 200-meter butterfly had not been a big event for me up till then, it was still I still had a chance. And even, there's, you know, two people make the team. I have a lane in the pool, and let's just see what I can do. And so I just sort of let go, and I remember dancing with my roommates and just having fun, you know, for a few days. And you have to understand, Olympic trials is one of the most intense meets. You see people around the pool deck who are crying, and because, you know, they've trained their lives for this. And
wow.
It's a very, very, very different experience. And so I had to just be able to be okay with whatever the results would be. And so I got to the place where I just went after it and saw what I could do, and I was fortunate enough to, and I share a lot of this in my book in Chapter 1 of making the Olympic team and walking through the details. I don't want to share too much on here so that people can actually read more detail on there, which is much more fun to read through step by step of me walking through, like, what experience as I walked in the natatorium and what I felt like emotionally. And I think there's a lot that goes into that whole experience that we all can relate to in life, But sometimes we are afraid to go into the depths of that kind of intensity.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm wondering what it is you do want to share with our listeners.
Well, I think the main thing is to know that you trust the process. Trust that if you have a dream of becoming an artist, to take the first step, even if you're doing something totally different right now. If you find that you love music, start playing music on a, you know, every day for 5-10 minutes to start. And take a step to do something you love to do. Because oftentimes if we get caught up in pursuing money or pursuing security or trying to be famous in a different way, but we're not satisfied in what we're doing, we're not going to be happy and fulfilled anyway. So it's better to do something, you know, even if it's just a hobby initially, towards something that really makes you feel fulfilled on a regular basis. It'll lead you to where you're supposed to go in your life. I really believe that.
Well, certainly. So I'm just wondering, again, one of the things that it's not real clear to me, I get that you had a lot of obstacles and you wanted to help other people as a therapist. I don't think that I quite get how you go from Olympic swimmer to therapist. And I'm wondering if you can kind of flesh that out for us a little bit so we understand what it is you bring to the therapy that you offer your clients.
Yeah, I mean, why would I want to become a therapist after being an Olympic swimmer, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think, you know, probably one thing that people may not, you know, top athletes oftentimes are looking for, what is that extra edge? How do I become a better performer? What goes on in my mind? How do I eat? How do I take care of myself? How do I sleep or get enough rest so that my body can perform in its optimal place? And so all of that, to me, really ties into why I'd want to become a therapist. It's, you know, and we all are searching to find that optimal place to be able to live from. And, you know, the athletics is a very simple proving ground to see what you are capable of doing. And to become a therapist from that is, you know, in my mind, it makes sense. It might not make sense in other people's mind, but I'm in a place where it's like, gosh, I want to pursue more like how do I help other people find their human potential? That is what I've been pursuing my whole life as an athlete. And so I wanted to become trained in a much deeper level psychologically so that I could understand, you know, where we get stuck in patterns and belief systems to then be able to alter them to be more open to having a different perspective and then therefore change our actions, which lead to different results. And
sure.
That's really what I do with people as I work with them on the phone or through Skype or through group, you know, sessions, or I'm also about to create online workshops. And it allows people to see that, it's funny, I also teach college sports psychology, and people, I have so many people now throughout the world because I teach it online, is I have people who are like, wow, you know, I'm not an athlete, but I got so much out of this course and what you teach, or I got so much out of your book, because it's not just about sports. It relates to every single thing we do in life. If I want to have a better relationship with somebody, it's important for me to understand how I am a relationship with myself. How do I view my parents or my siblings or people when I was young? How does that play out today as I do work with people? And what we see is we all have patterns of how we do stuff, whether it's an athlete or a person in relationship or somebody who's a parent or in a corporate job, whatever it might be, it all is the same stuff. We're all here continuously striving to be better than we were the day before. And when we get stuck and we try and get lazy or we don't want to do it, that's just a way of protecting ourselves from actually being in that blissful, happy place. And so I walk three people through my book about how do you actually take steps? How can you actually, you know, dream big? If you were allowed to be a little kid again and have no fears, what would you create for yourself in your life? And what's stopping you from taking a step toward it right now?
So what if somebody tells you, well, you know, what's stopping me is I don't have enough money?
Yes, well, you know, and it's a very interesting thing. So let's say I wanted to pursue a sport. I was going to make that up, but let's say I want to pursue a sport. I don't have money. Maybe I can't buy the equipment, or maybe I can do an exchange with somebody. Maybe I can give us some of my own services. Maybe I can tutor their own child or something to be able to have services for them coaching me, or something can be worked out. There's always, you know, I think what happens is sometimes we get stuck in details trying to figure out all the potential obstacles and how we're going to work them out before, rather than just setting the intention of, I'm going to allow myself to be able to train for this event. I don't know how it's all going to work yet, but I'm going to actually take the steps to make this a reality for myself. And ironically, when we set the intention, it's like the universe that, you know, gets out of the way and helps us create it so that things can fall in place for us to make this happen for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what if somebody said that they thought they were too old? What do you say to clients who feel like they're too old?
Well, it depends on what they're doing. I mean, there is, you know, I do believe in the power of dreams and going after what you want, but there is a point also, too, where we have to be realistic. If I'm 4 feet tall and I'm a male person and want to play basketball, it's going to probably be pretty hard to be on the, you know, pro basketball team.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, I mean, there are, same thing with swimming. I mean, most top swimmers are not small either, and yet at the same time, there's always exceptions to the rule. And so it's a matter of saying, okay, how can I make this work? Is it really realistic for me? And I think, you know, I've also studied a lot of martial arts and Taoism, and I think a lot of this goes into, okay, you know, if you're going down a river and there's rocks in the way, sometimes the water will flow around the rocks. Sometimes it will get stuck in a little pool, and if there's a whole bunch of rocks. And sometimes
okay.
Life is meant to be flowing for us, not difficult. And I think what happens is sometimes we get stuck in our egos, you know, and that's where we like to suffer and feel like it's supposed to be difficult rather than making it easy. And so the more we can see what is our natural path and follow that, our life will take us where we're supposed to go. It's when we try and start, you know, putting a square peg into a circle hole that things get difficult for us.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, and
sometimes we get an athlete that will come to us, and they'll be like, but I really want to be a sprinter. And we'll say, well, your God-given talent is to be a distance swimmer. You know, sometimes that's just a fact. It doesn't mean they can't become a great sprinter if they really want to be, but they might physically be more gifted in another area. And that's where a person has choices about what they want to pursue. It's kind of like somebody might love to sing. Like, you know, they may not have the voice for it initially, but maybe if they really practice a lot and every day and consistently, they can become a great singer. And so it's a matter of making a decision of how disciplined and dedicated they are to their actual dream.
Right. Don't you think that a lot of things do come down to that, that sometimes people feel, oh, I wish I was this, and I wish I had that, and you know, but then really they're not willing to put in what is required to get there.
Yes, and that's a big one that, you know, as I work with kids to this day even, it's like, okay, what your dream is to go to the Olympic Games. Do you know what that means for you? Do you want to go be a spectator in the stands, or do you actually want to be competing? They're very, very different. And then what do you know what it takes? Are you willing to do whatever it takes? And it's funny, about half the hands will not go up anymore at that point because a lot of kids are not sure they want to dedicate that. You know, it's funny, we have to be willing to trust ourselves enough and approve of who we are, even as others around us might judge us for having such a dream. And this happens because many people, if they can't look at their own dreams, they're going to judge other people around them who are going after their dreams. And that's where we have to be strong enough inside of ourselves to know that, hey, you know what? This is a dream of mine. I'm going to go after it, even though Johnny and Susie and these other people are telling me I'm crazy. And because, or even my parents are telling me crazy. Think of any people out there who have been, become really, you know, a well-known artist or a musician or something else, where we know their parents were like, no, but I wanted you to be a lawyer, Johnny. What happened? And meanwhile, they said, no, this is in my heart. I know I'm supposed to do this other path. And ironically, when people stay focused, it's that they've already come over the biggest hurdle at a younger age by just making the choice to follow what they love to do. That's the hardest part sometimes, is having other people around you, especially parents, telling kids that that's not what they're supposed to do or they're not going to approve of what they're doing. And meanwhile, the kid says, no, but this is what I'm supposed to do. And often if we let the kid develop that inner self that knows what they're here to do, it really leads them on their path of really fulfilling and being successful in what they're trying to pursue.
What do you think a lot of people I talk to, a lot of my clients, don't exactly know what their purpose is, what they want to do. You know, there's kind of a sense of confusion. Frustration, like I wish I knew what I was supposed to do or wanted to do. Do you have clients that have those kind of obstacles? And if so, how do you help them get focused?
I share a whole chapter two of my book is about embracing your own inner Olympian. And inner Olympian meaning that you also have a big dream inside of you or desires of things that you like to do that maybe have been squashed, totally have forgotten about because you're afraid to even acknowledge that those are what you really like. And so I walk through exercises like the magic wand, where I first help people get into their power and get excited about just feeling good, because sometimes we forget what it feels like to feel good. When we get into a mundane job or not really sure who we are, or we're being indecisive or we're procrastinating, we're not in a very good state at that point. So the first thing to do is get, you know, I have an exercise called smile highs. Look up at the ceiling with a big grin on your face just because you can, and who cares if you feel like you're being silly. You hold that smile on your face for 15 seconds. It alters your physiology. By changing your physiology, you change your emotional state. And then I actually walk through a visualization and helping people realize that the more and more I can relax and go back into that innocent little person who still has dreams. You know, go back in and honor that little child inside of us who still wants to do something. And, you know, pretend you have a magic wand. If you had no fears, who would you be? What would you do? What would you create for yourself? What would you have? And then just go ahead and write nonstop for a couple minutes. And let everything come out. Let the subconscious talk to you. It might be, I want to jump out of an airplane. I want to be able to climb, you know, Mount Everest. I want to be able to become a CEO. I want to be the President of the United States. I want to be able to have a family of four kids. I want to be happily married. I want to be able to get along better with my siblings. It doesn't matter what it is. And you just start writing. I want to have a pet name, you know, whatever it might be. And what happens is, as we start allowing the free-flowing thoughts to come, sometimes we go, oh, well, that's too silly. I can't write that down. And you just write every single thing down. There's nothing that's too silly. Nothing's right or wrong. And what happens is, we let the subconscious take over. Answers come to us if we listen. And what happens nowadays, I find, is so many people are getting bombarded with social media, texting, the Facebook, all these kinds of things, you know, having our phones with us all the time, computers, is that we're bombarded by distraction all the time. If we're watching TV, it's, you know, all the media stuff. And it's important to have time to get quiet enough to be able to listen within and know what we really want, who we really are, rather than listening to all these outside influences that would make us think, oh, well, if you have this car, then you're going to get this girlfriend. And then because you have this girlfriend, you're going to feel great and powerful. And ironically, is that really, it's kind of, that's called advertising. It's not really who we are. And just because you get an Olympic gold medal, or because all of a sudden you're married or you have a great job and you're making millions, it doesn't make you necessarily happy. I mean, I know many people who are, you know, have achieved in many great ways, and yet they're not satisfied because they've never learned to find peace within themselves throughout the process. And so it's really about taking steps back to find out and trust and enjoy ourselves for who we are, rather than trying to, sometimes we have so much shame around parts of ourselves or mistakes that we've made, and we need to learn to forgive ourselves, forgive others, ask for forgiveness, and be in a place where we can honor that, hey, this is who I am. This is part of life. I'm totally partaking in life. Yes, I've made some mistakes, but I'm okay with that. I've learned to say, okay, I've learned from this mistake, and I'm now moving on to continue to be who I really am. So I don't know if that answers your question. I know it's a long-winded answer. But I think it's important for people to trust in the process and get quiet enough and listen inside.
Right, and try to get some centered. And it sounds like you have some great brainstorming exercises there for people to kind of explore their options. I like the idea of getting in touch with that original fantasy of what you wanted to be when you were a kid, when you were growing up.
Yeah. Because, you know, some kids grow up and be like, you know, I just love pretending that I am maybe see a certain actor or actress on TV. And they go, I want to be able to play that role out, you know? And they all of a sudden, they start imagining being that person. And what happens is, like, that might be a part that really excites them and sparks them. And one thing I like to work with when I work with clients is, what gives you your energy? When do you feel most excited? And I usually can tell in their voice or their body language what is exciting for them and what gives them energy. And if it's giving you energy, that's something that you should pursue.
Yeah, absolutely. So if, what about you? Did you... Have you moved on and walked away from sports? Is there sports after the Olympics? How does that feel?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was so sick, I was not able to even do swimming. And so I really, really missed it. And I was in a place where I really was hoping to get back in the water. And so, you know, I was able to go back in 2004 and compete in Olympic trials again. It was kind of like a nice completion for me, because even though I was not as fast as I had been when I was younger, I was in a position, I was 33 at the time, I was in a position where I really just loved being able to participate and be able to love getting in the water. And so to this day, I get in the water a few times a week. Every once in a while, there's masters swimming where you can go to, I mean, there's people who swim up to age 100 or older in these masters competitions. It's a very big community where people can be involved still. and, you know, pursue being able to have that mind and body come together and transform into that magical moment where you see everything take place in a race. But, you know, at this point, I have, you know, my focus is not so much on me training to be at my optimal performance for a race and swimming so much, as I'm very interested in how my energy flows and I feel balanced and if my mind feels really alert. I have two kids who are 6 and 5 years old, and so I love doing yoga and some Qigong and Tai Chi, and then doing some, you know, aerobic exercises as well as, you know, some strength work. And, you know, for example, my 40, I was very excited. I had built myself up to a place where I want to do 4 sets of 10 pull-ups. So I still, like, love giving myself little challenges to see what I can do as my body changes as I get older. But I'm also in a position where I just love still being able to use my body. If when I'm using my body, I feel like it's helping my brain function. And it helps me be, you know, in a happier place. And I just, I feel very much at home being able to be physical.
Yeah, I really enjoy physical exercise as well. And I like doing all of them. I just spent a weekend doing about 4 hours total of ecstatic dancing. And it was amazing to me how many muscles I got to use that I don't usually use. And I have a very active life. I do hiking, swimming, weightlifting, and two different kinds of yoga, Kundalini yoga and Vinyasa flow. So I have a very, very active life, and I use a lot of different modalities. And I did this ecstatic dancing, and I was like, wow. Today I realize I'm sore.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. It's funny how that happens. Isn't it? I used to train with a bunch of other athletes. There was a place in Pennsylvania where a bunch of different athletes were on this, you know, land where we all were able to train triathletes and cyclists and wrestlers and swimmers and pentathletes. And bottom line is, I remember when wrestlers used to come in the pool area and they would get in the water. Well, of course, it's hard for them to swim because they don't float very well. They don't have a lot of body fat. And then for us to go in the wrestling room and try and do some of their moves, I mean, it's like, whoa, your body, different muscle groups get used very differently. And all of a sudden you're like, I didn't even know I had these muscles in here. So it is true. It's kind of like that for life. You know, we all get to use the muscle of our brain and our heart, and to be able to, sometimes we get very focused and can be machine-like rather than being in our heart center working with people. Or sometimes we get too caught up and getting caught up in the social life and forgetting to take care of ourselves on a physical level or some other place. And so it's, for me, I really feel, and I share about this in my book, is it's a constant balancing act of what do I really want to pursue, what's my top priority, and how can I do that on a daily basis.
Well, you were talking about people feeling overwhelmed because they've got so many things now with texting and email and voicemail. And, you know, it's like we're so inundated with input. And I think the biggest issue now is for people to find time to be able to actually enjoy living.
Yes.
You know, to pull away from that stuff. Do you think some things kind of have to fall by the wayside, or can we do it all?
Well, it's funny. You know, I think before I got sick, I used to think, oh, yes, we can do it all. And I do still believe on some level there's a lot more that we're capable of doing than most people realize. I think when people find that they're sleeping a lot, they're getting lazy or feel depressed, it's oftentimes because they aren't doing what they really love to do. And so they don't feel satisfied. They feel irritable because they know there's something there's something amiss. And yet at the same time, you know, I have found that even when I came back and trained when I was, you know, in 2004, is that there is a fine art of balance that goes into everything. And I think part of the reason why I ended up getting really sick is I was burning my candle at both ends and in the middle too. And I had a coach who believed in trying to keep up with these steroids using these tremors at the time. And so we were training a ton and we were overtrained and our bodies were shutting down. And it's a very, you know, there's a much smarter way, and it's happening now with athletes, and I learned this even in 2004, is that my rest period is as important as my training period. And ironically, in 2004, I trained so much less than I ever had, and I was still able to perform at a very high level, even after having been sick for 8 years and not swimming at all. And so I think if people take a step back, it's kind of like somebody who's the boss of a bunch of people and they try and handle all of it themselves rather than learning to ask for help and facilitate out the responsibilities and the duties. It's learning to be able to delegate and having that time to take little daydreams and be able to go for a walk and do something fun, because if we're always just trying to be so task-oriented, we actually can't be as creative and thoughtful in terms of what we do want to keep creating. We can get on the treadmill and keep running and forget what we're here to do. And so it's very important to take a step back and assess, and I really believe it's good to do this about every, at least every 6 months, and look back and say, okay, how have these 6 months worked for me? How do I want to change it for the next 6 months? How can I, what pieces do I want to keep? What can I alter a little bit? And what do I need to let go of? And all of a sudden, you know, it can keep shifting, therefore allowing us to be around people that support us in who we are here to be, and getting rid of the extra baggage that we're carrying around, whether it's being around people that suck our energy versus, you know, having a give-and-take relationship. Maybe it means having to ask for guidance from people and knowing that it's okay to have the downtime. I think our society is so caught up in trying to make us strive rather than enjoy and thrive.
Yes, and boy, it's hard to give yourself permission for that. One of the things that I have been working with some of my clients on, and myself, working with myself on this, is to allow myself to not always do it perfectly. So if I think, oh, well, I don't have time for my usual 40 minutes of yoga, then I won't bother. It's like, okay, do 10 minutes even. 10 minutes is better than nothing.
Yeah.
And if I missed my daily walk because the phone wouldn't stop ringing off the hook or something, and I had crises that I had to handle, to give myself permission to even just step outside for 10 minutes to hear the birds, connect with nature, you know, just run around my yard.
Yes, and know that life will still go on even though we're not doing everything we're supposed to do in that moment.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that because there's a lot of times where we're taught that we have to stay on this treadmill, and yet when we get off, we go, oh, thank goodness, I can breathe again. And that's the point where I go into in my book about, you know, letting go of the stress, because what is causing you the stress? And there's times where time has stood still, and I've worked out for hours, or I've been working with people for hours, and I just feel like, oh, wow, that went by so fast. And there's other times where you just feel so drained from something, and that's feedback about what you're energized by doing. And I feel like when you actually are on your path, you know what you need to cut out and not spend so much time on. And it might mean for me when I was swimming at the elite level, it was like, okay, it's not realistic for me to go out till 2 a.m. in the morning and be drinking alcohol or doing the other things that sometimes we want to do or having sex or doing all these different kinds of things that can happen or getting caught up in needing to do all these things to fit in. And so I had to learn that I had to be okay with who I am rather than trying to not be okay with who I am. I'm going to be liked by other people. Because if I'm seeking, reacting to and trying to get my approval from other people, I'll never feel satisfied because I can never guarantee what other people will think of me. But I can take care of what I think of myself. And if I'm taking care of myself and approving of what I do, I will like myself, which will allow me to therefore ultimately even attract people who will like me too. And so it's important because we all get caught up in a parole. We all get caught up in wanting security, and then our egos go, you're not being good enough, you're not being good enough, or we make things black and white about the perfection. And so when we can actually see that it's okay to be perfectly imperfect, you know, and realize that we gain so much by just actually pursuing the trying and going after what we want and doing what we want. And, yes, do 2 minutes of yoga if that's all we have time for. Take a few minutes to stretch in the shower if that's all you're going to have time for the first hour of your day. It just take time to have even that first step. And I find oftentimes when I work with clients that when they start getting back to just taking that first step to maybe play music again for 5 minutes, they go, wow, I'm back to playing it every day, and I'm putting it back into my day for half an hour, and it's helping me with everything else. I'm getting more done. It's wonderful. And those are the kind of moments of ahas that we all want to create for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they absolutely are. And, you know, I did something today, which I've never done before, which is when I was out, you know, today. It was Monday, for God's sake. There's probably a lot of people that were having a Monday in the traditional sense where it's just, you know, you feel like you're kind of getting hit with a whole bunch of stuff. And when I did get out of the house, I went out of the house a couple times, one to pick stuff out of the garden, which that was really nice. It was, yes, it was utilitarian, but I also got a chance to just connect with Mother Earth. And then later on, towards the end of my day, I went out just to walk around. And I learned this in a workshop that I took at the Honey Root Women's Retreat that I was teaching at and participating in over the weekend here in Nevada City. And it was a beautiful event. And
So I took this class on, it was about self pleasure, and it was kind of unexpected because I might have thought that it was going to have some sexual overtone, but it didn't. It was cultivating fertile ground, pleasure, and self-care, and it was by a woman by the name of Denise Reynolds. Great class, and she had brought in all of these herbs, and they really were just things that you could pick out of the forest or out of your yard. And she had us arrange them in like little bouquets and then just twist the leaves so that it would release their fragrance.
Oh, beautiful,
and, So I found that I could just do that, taking a walk in my backyard. I could just say, well, that's an interesting leaf, and then I'd pick it and twist it, and it would release its scent. And it was like instant aromatherapy for no cost whatsoever.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So
I believe it too. When you get into nature, it's really grounds and it makes us feel connected because we are all connected. That's one of the beautiful things about the Olympic Games is, you know, and I love to be able to work as a therapist through or as a coach now, is that we are all much more connected than not throughout the world. And when we can see that we all have fears, we all have dreams, and then we can unite that peace within us, integrate that duality that we all face, we can connect with nature, we feel that oneness, and then we feel peaceful. And that's what we're all really seeking in the end anyway.
Yeah, it's true. Just to confirm that. And I remember learning something else, which was that, you know, like the plants, the trees, the forest, they all have like their own vibration. And when you step out into nature and give yourself a chance to connect with nature, it can change your vibration. So it's not just a psychological process of taking a break. And it's not, you know, just the mental process of feeling like, oh, wow, that's a beautiful sunset, or isn't that moon lovely? But it's actually an energetic process where you are kind of getting in sync with nature on kind of, just on your vibration.
Right, vibrational energy, yes.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting is people spend more time in front of computers and technology and screens is that we're altering. When we do that, the frequency coming off the screen is actually alters our own frequency, which does not usually feel so good. And so sometimes people will experience when they're in front of the computer for 2 hours that they're feeling edgy. And it's because literally they need to, I mean, if they don't take a step out in nature and go for a walk for 5 minutes, it'll literally change their energy again. And so nature has a powerful healing effect for everybody.
That is a really good point, and I spend I spend a lot of time in front of this computer, either, you know, doing Facebook, Twitter, my radio programs, email, booking clients, you know, surfing the web, and, of course, sometimes I'm watching YouTube. I mean, my God, there's so much.
It's like a whole other world on there, and yet... And so what's happening is they're finding this with younger kids in particular, because their brains, up till age 8, are still not even fully developed, is they're finding that they're having issues with the synapses of the brain in different parts of the brain are not getting wired the same because they're becoming more sedentary. You know, what caused, you know, Einstein or some other people to be so, you know, brilliant, ultimately, is because they were doing a physical activity while listening to music and thinking about a math problem. They weren't just sitting in front of the computers, being sedentary, and then eating a lot, and then, you know, ultimately not being able to use their body and brain the same way, because the body physically ultimately helps the mind work. And it's all connected, and if we're not going out to nature more like we used to, or if we're losing nature, if we're living in a city and there's concrete all around us, it's important to have some plants, even by our computer or in our home, because it'll just help change the energy, too. And or even having crystals can really alter the frequency by your computer for the better.
What do you think? I have it on the back side, so I'm facing my computer, and behind me is it's just the size of a huge, huge slice of pizza, size and shape. But it's a crystal amethyst. I wonder what kind of effect that would have. Any idea?
I would put that right by your computer screen.
Oh,
and
really?
Yeah, the power of crystals are really, really good for the energy, especially when you're on your phone or, you know, computer. And I've read before, too, and I mean, I don't know a lot about crystals, how they work. I just know that they have a powerful frequency, that vibrational energy that comes off of them, and they have different kinds ultimately also give different energies. But, you know, any kind of crystal near your computer is going to help you not take in all the electromagnetic radiation that comes off of the machines.
Mm.
It's crazy all the stuff that goes on, and I think what's happening is that, you know, a lot of doctors are finally starting to acknowledge this, that cell phones, and what's happening is a lot of people are getting brain tumors because of the energy of the cell phone and by our ears. And so a lot of people really encourage people to wear, you know, headsets and that kind of stuff. But I think most importantly is, even if you just get off these things and go into nature and just get back connected and change your energetic frequency or meditate or do some martial arts or whatever it might be, yoga, it's going to help you keep your energy balanced, which is so crucial nowadays.
Yes. Oh, man. I find that the yoga is just, now that I've started doing it, I can't really, I don't feel good if it goes a day without it.
Yeah, I feel the same way if I don't do my Qigong or meditation. And even sometimes it takes even a few minutes of just deep breathing and stretching, because it just moves the body and energy flow. And absolutely, and that's a wonderful place to be, because then you know, okay, gosh, it's kind of like somebody who's eating a ton of candy all day, and then all of a sudden they just stop, you know, maybe they stop having coffee and sugar. And all of a sudden, like, you know, a few weeks later, they go, God, I have so much energy, I feel so much better. And then you go back to having the coffee. It's like, oh, why did I do that? I feel so much better without it. And that's the place we want to be living from. And knowing that, saying, oh, gosh, I want to feel good. This does feel good. When I do my yoga, I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to make sure I carve out time in my day for this special thing that it makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, really important. Well, look, boy, this hour's just flown by. I think this would be a good time for you to share with our listeners how they can get a hold of you, and how they can get a copy of your book.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm available via my website, katrinaradke.com. That's KatrinaRadke.com. And on my website, you can also buy my book. You can sign up for my newsletter as well. I have a blog on there. And then I also, my husband and I, who he's an Olympic coach and former Stanford coach, we've actually created your own fitness DVD for fitness and health for anybody trying to be, whether you're trying to be a world-class athlete or somebody who just wants to be healthy and fit. There's 7 ultimate fitness routines on the video. It's a whole year's worth of different exercises. And videos are about 15 to 20 minutes in length, each of them are. And the package gives you about almost 3 hours of video. So there's a lot of different things that can be done. You know, my book, Be Your Best Without the Stress, they're both available on my website, as well as my book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online retailers as well. And I'd love to hear from people. If they have any questions, feel free to email me at katrina@katrinaradke.com. And I'd love to hear from you.
Fabulous. And now, are those DVDs mostly about swimming?
No, they are not.
Okay.
They are, some of it has a little bit of yoga and Pilates in it. But there's about half of them are no equipment at all, because we wanted to keep it from beginner all the way to advanced. So there's two DVDs are beginner, and then there's several that are intermediate, and then the last few are advanced. So the most equipment you need are like maybe a couple, you know, dumbbells and Swiss ball and medicine ball if you wish, and tubing. Otherwise, you really don't need equipment, though. We've set it up so you don't need equipment. You can do it on the road. You can do it on your iPod. You can do it anywhere. But the idea is that you can get a really good workout in 15 minutes and or have a very relaxing work, you know, exercise via breathing and stretching. So we have all of it on there. And for the idea, and we also have some bloopers, which are fun. So it's good for people who, you know, it's always good. People are always looking for a different routine. And my husband, actually, he's an exercise physiologist who knows a ton about how the body works. And we also are very into what kind of exercises work to empower the mind and the person. And so they're purposely picked to help people feel good and be fit.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, you are certainly an inspiration, Katrina. And thanks so much for joining me in the Shame-Free Zone. To our listeners,
well,
once again.
Well, thank you. I love your title of your show, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
May we all be fulfilled and feel good inside.
Absolutely. No shame. My guest tonight again was Katrina Radke, a former Olympic swimmer and author of the new book, Be Your Best Without the Stress. And that's it from the Shame-Free Zone for tonight. I'll see you back here next Monday. Thanks and good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian. Kenapa tak mentus kabar berita?